Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Davis. Counsel for the defense.
May it please the court. Chief Judge Efron, honorable judges of this court, good morning. I'm Major John Page, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Mark Strickland, we represent the appellant in this case, Airman First Class Jess Davis. In this case, both the military judge and the Court of Criminal Appeals erred when they required the appellant to demonstrate prejudice through his deprivation of a substantial pretrial right. And in this case, that was the right to a public Article 32 investigation. The Court of Criminal Appeals was correct when it concluded that the military judge abused his discretion. But where the Court of Criminal Appeals went wrong in this case was then requiring appellant to demonstrate prejudice on appeal in order to obtain relief. That requirement that he demonstrate prejudice on appeal runs contrary to established case law from this honorable court, which begins with United States versus Mickle and includes cases such as Donaldson, Chestnut, and runs through United States versus Chukalot. Those cases stand for the proposition that when an accused is denied a substantial pretrial right and makes a timely objection at trial, that this court simply will not test for prejudice on appeal.
How do you deal with Article 59 then?
Well, Your Honor,
what do we do with Article 59?
Your Honor, at the time that those cases were decided, Article 59A was in effect, and those cases don't specifically make mention of Article 59, but I think the way to look at that and what those cases seem to do with Article 59 is, in particular, Mickle talks about when the case comes to trial, talks about the rights, the pretrial rights basically merging with the rights at trial. And arguably in this case that did not happen because there was a timely objection, and so the court-martial never should have proceeded in the first place, and because the court-martial never should have proceeded, really Article 59A doesn't come into effect when you're just looking at errors that impact the pretrial proceedings, Your Honor.
Do you think it's, is it your view that it's impossible to read Mickle in a way that is consistent with Article 59?
I don't think it's impossible to read Mickle consistent with Article 59, Your Honor. And primarily for that reason, just in that Article 59A, primarily dealing with errors from the court-martial proceeding itself. And because the court-martial in this case never should have proceeded, because the military judge should have returned it and reopened the Article 32 investigation, that Article 59A wouldn't come into play in this particular case, just as a Mickle.
You say it should never have proceeded. Are you saying that this error was jurisdictional?
Not jurisdictional, Your Honor, but just that the military judge erred by not sending it back for to open the Article 32 investigation.
Can I ask you about your antecedent supposition that the closure of the Article 32 investigation for portions of the Article 32 was a denial of a substantial pretrial right? Can you point me to language of this court that supports that antecedent proposition?
Yes, Your Honor. In this court's opinion, in ABC versus Powell.
I'm familiar with the case. Can you point me to the language where it calls it a substantial pretrial right? Because I've looked at the case fairly carefully this morning, and I don't see that language.
Well, Your Honor, I would agree that I don't know that Powell necessarily specifically uses that term, substantial pretrial right.
Isn't Powell interpreting RCM 405H3, and isn't it possible for the court for the rules of court-martial to afford accused greater rights than the Constitution? You'd agree with that proposition?
Yes, Your Honor.
So it's not necessarily the case that an interpretation of RCM 405H3 constitutes the court's decision that it's a Sixth Amendment right or a substantial pretrial right.
That, in other words, that the Sixth, that this court's interpretation of the Sixth Amendment affords a military accused a public Article 32 investigation does not by itself make it a substantial pretrial right. Is that your question, Your Honor?
No. I'm saying that the court's determination that RCM 405H3 should be interpreted to in favor of a public trial does not turn 405H3 into a Sixth Amendment right.
Correct, Your Honor. Now, in this case, as I mentioned, the decision of the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals basically sets out a decision that was contrary to that line of cases from this honorable court. And the effect of the Court of Criminal Appeals decision effectively placed Airman Davis at the mercy of the trial judge in this case, who had an erroneous view of the law, as he required him to demonstrate prejudice during the motion hearing at trial. And there's really two problems with requiring the appellant to demonstrate prejudice under the circumstances. The first is, as I mentioned, the case law from this honorable court. And then second of all, practically speaking, it's nearly impossible to demonstrate prejudice to the deprivation of this kind of a right. And I think this court made that clear in its opinion in United States versus Hershey when it was talking about a military accused's right to a public trial. And in that case, this court stated that if a military accused is deprived of the right to a public trial, that in that case the accused is not required to demonstrate prejudice because, practically speaking, it's nearly impossible to do so.
How is it impossible to demonstrate prejudice or lack thereof in this case?
Well, it's difficult, Your Honor, because there were two witnesses that were really the pivotal government witnesses. Now, one of them...
And they testified at the Article 32 investigation, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the defendant was present at the Article 32 investigation?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the defense counsel was present at the Article 32 investigation, was afforded the opportunity to cross-examine the putative witnesses?
Yes, Your Honor.
And those same witnesses testified at the public trial?
They did, Your Honor.
And the trial was an open hearing?
It was, Your Honor.
And they were subject to cross-examination there as well.
That's correct.
And in part, the Article 32 investigation hearing testimony was used in that cross-examination.
Yes, Your Honor.
So how is it not possible for this court to find very easily that there's no prejudice here?
Well, the reason being, Your Honor, is at the Article 32 investigation, when that hearing was closed, there were members of the public that were removed, and that's evident from the investigating officer's report. And as this court discussed in Hershey, really the significance of having a public hearing is that witnesses are encouraged to come forward and testify truthfully, and that all the participants of the trial are encouraged to perform to the highest standards.
And Hershey is a case that is in the context of a public hearing, a public trial under the Sixth Amendment, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And you're not suggesting that the witnesses here did not testify at a public hearing?
They did at the court-martial, Your Honor, correct. But as far as the pretrial hearing, they did not.
Are you telling us, was their testimony markedly different at the public hearing than it was at the Article 32 investigation?
Really, Your Honor, it was fairly consistent, but...
So if the question is the crucible of or light of public exposure, didn't that happen here?
At the trial, yes, Your Honor. I mean, there was a public trial, but we submit that the fact that there was a public trial did not obviate the problem that we had at the pretrial proceeding. And Mikkel talks about errors such as this in the pretrial proceeding having a significant effect on the integrity of the court-martial process itself. And the reason it's so difficult to demonstrate particular prejudice in this case is that, we really don't know what would have happened as far as their testimony, those two witnesses, at the Article 32 investigation, if it had been an open hearing. You're correct, Your Honor, that the testimony was fairly consistent between the two. However, that's, again, part of the difficulty of demonstrating prejudice and why it shouldn't be appropriate in this case is because they may very well have testified somewhat differently. Obviously, once they've testified one way at the Article 32 investigation, there's a good chance that they're going to make an effort to testify consistently with that at the trial level.
Does your argument turn on our accepting that the assertion that the portion of the Article 32 investigation that was closed was a, quote, critical part of the Article 32 investigation, as you state in your brief? Or could it have been any improper closure, no matter how short, no matter how insignificant the evidence or issues presented to the investigating officer during the closed portion were? Is it any closure that, in your view, requires a per se reversal?
Well, certainly there would have to be a defense objection at trial.
Okay, so there's a defense objection at trial. Is it your view that as long as there's a defense objection at trial, that any closure of the Article 32 investigation that wasn't based on an appropriate analysis or factual basis, it requires per se reversal?
Yes, Your Honor, and that, because of the previous case law from this court, such as Donaldson and Chocolate.
Well, counsel, suppose the only portion of the hearing, the pretrial hearing that's closed, is one in which the judge decides to review some photographs that one of the parties wants to introduce. And those photographs subsequently do not become part of the trial whatsoever. And everybody on appeal would agree that they have no bearing. Why would that require per se reversal?
Yeah, and I guess I should go back and, if I may, I'd like to somewhat amend my answer to Judge Ryan's question. I think the focus is really on the testimony of witnesses. That's really the fundamental aspect of having a public Article 32 investigation. And I think that's what this court in Hershey made clear, is that really the benefit of having a public hearing is to have witnesses come forward and testify truthfully. So in response to Your Honor's question about if it was just a limited closure for the purpose of looking at photographs, I think that would be difficult to make the case that that should cause, you know, basically a reversal and a conviction later on appeal.
So it's not a per se rule. It's a rule that depends on your perception of there being prejudice from certain evidence being available in a public or closed to the public portion of the hearing.
I think that definitely plays a role in it, Your Honor.
Draw an analogy to unlawful command influence, which is one of the areas of intense focus by this court. If prior to trial the command issues statements which have the effect of chilling the testimony of witnesses, the case law that we have says that that's not a per se requirement to dismiss the charges. Rather, it places the burden on the government to demonstrate a lack of prejudice. Article 59 is applied, but there's a burden-shifting process here. And it's possible in that case for the case to go forward if, for example, there's demonstration that curative measures are taken, that the testimony of the witnesses was not significant, et cetera. Why is that any different in a situation in Article 32? That is, suppose the testimony that was chilled was in an Article 32. Would that preclude the government from demonstrating at trial, beyond a reasonable doubt, that there was no prejudice from command influence exercised in an Article 32?
Your Honor, I don't believe that that would preclude the government from being able to demonstrate that. I mean,
okay, so why should it be any different here? We don't necessarily have the same burden-shifting process, but conceptually, if the government isn't precluded from demonstrating by whatever standard in a command influence case in absence of prejudice, why shouldn't the government be allowed to demonstrate in a closure case the absence of prejudice? We can talk about what that standard should be and who the burden is on, but assuming without deciding that the burden's on the government, why shouldn't the government be permitted to make that showing?
Well, I think for two reasons, Your Honor. I mean, first would be going back again to this court's earlier decisions in Mikkel, Donaldson, and Chukwuelate, which indicates that this court would not, the prejudice analysis really does not come into play unless it's an issue that's being raised for the first time on appeal, and it was never objected to at trial. And the second aspect of it would be just going back to this court's decision in Hershey, which talks about the practical difficulties inherent in conducting a prejudice analysis when the issue is an open versus a closed hearing.
Those practical difficulties apply in command influence cases. That is, if the commander is issued a statement chilling witnesses, can be extremely difficult to demonstrate who was not, who did not come forward once those chilling statements were made. And yet we find cases in which the government meets that burden. In many cases it can't, and the case is reversed. So I'm trying to figure out why would this be any different? That is, in a sense, in essence, your argument is one of chilling statements as a result of the absence of public exposure.
Well, Your Honor, I guess to a certain extent I would have to concede that it's difficult to demonstrate a real significant difference between the two situations.
Well, if that's the case, then let's assume, without deciding, that the burden is on the government in this case to demonstrate, by whatever standard, an absence of prejudice. Why would it be? Why would you argue that the government? Can you argue, and if so, what is the argument as to whether the government can meet that burden in this case with regard to the specific circumstances in this case?
I would submit, Your Honor, that the government cannot meet the burden in this case for the following reasons, really, because, again, we can't rewind the proceeding and insert the public and figure out how these particular witnesses, would have testified differently, if at all. And it's certainly a possibility that because of maybe different testimony would have come out that certain of the charges could have been dismissed before proceeding to trial. It's possible that the defense could have developed potential impeachment evidence at the Article 32 investigation that could have been used at trial to attack some of the testimony on those specifications that the appellant was convicted of. So because you can't go back and then insert the public element into this proceeding, we submit that the government cannot demonstrate that in fact there was no prejudice in this case.
Counsel, is this constitutional error?
In the sense that it implicates the appellant's Sixth Amendment right to a public Article 32 investigation.
Well, in constitutional error cases, don't we test for whether it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt? Isn't that a prejudice analysis?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well,
I'm sorry. Sorry, Judge Stuckey.
No.
Well, Your Honor, it's a curious result that, and again, I'd have to go back to the cases that this court's previously decided in terms of Nicola Donaldson and Chukwuelate.
Well, but did those involve constitutional error, or was that basically structural error or jurisdictional?
Right. Not necessarily constitutional errors, Your Honor, but we would submit that they were also dealing with substantial pretrial rights, as we had in this case here.
Can you finish the answer? Is it constitutional error? Why is it constitutional error to begin with?
Just in that...
What is the constitutional right to a public Article 32 in its entirety? Is that what the constitutional right is? Where do you find that in the Constitution?
Well, and I'm basing that, Your Honor, primarily on this court's decision in Powell, and just in that.
Right, but putting aside citation of case law, what's your view? Are you arguing that there is a constitutional right to a public Article 32 hearing? It's part of the CCA includes it as part of its analysis, assumes that this is a constitutional error. So I'm trying to figure out, you've indicated that there's other parts of the CCA's opinion you don't agree with, and I'm wondering if you would take a crack at this part of it as well. Perhaps you want to do so in rebuttal.
That might be better, Your Honor.
Okay, as you wish.
Well, let me
it's
ask
your
you,
chance.
Let me ask you this question. Do defendants have a right to an open grand jury proceeding under the Sixth Amendment?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor.
And isn't a grand jury investigation similar to an Article 32 investigation, a preliminary investigation to determine that there's probable cause an offense has been committed, then an accused committed it?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so neither an Article 32 investigation nor a grand jury proceeding are criminal prosecutions. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
And we established early on that the president can establish rules under the RCM that are more expansive in terms of the rights that they give accused than the Constitution requires.
Yes, Your Honor. Now, looking at the line of cases that I mentioned previously, from Meckle through Chukalat, the court has employed a fairly consistent methodology in terms of analyzing those cases and coming up with a particular result. Meckle dealt with a different substantial pretrial right. That was the right to qualified counsel in an Article 32 hearing. And this court found that because there was no objection made at trial, that once the case came on to appeal, that they were going to test for prejudice. And that's where this court laid out the language, obviously, that's frequently quoted regarding an accused, when he makes a timely objection, being entitled to judicial enforcement of his substantial pretrial right. This court also noted that Donaldson contributed to a correct reading of the Mickle language. And in Donaldson, which was an opinion authored by then Chief Judge Quinn, who also authored Mickle, in that case, they were dealing with whether or not the Article 32 investigation was convened by an officer empowered to do so. And because there was an objection made at trial, the court did set aside the conviction as to the effect of specification and also set aside the sentence. There was another charge that was not investigated under Article 32, and because there was no objection to that particular charge, this court declined to set aside the finding of guilty for that particular charge. And that method of analysis really continues up through Chukalat, a 1978 decision from this honorable court, in which, again, the opinion in that case makes clear that in the face of timely objection to the deprivation of a substantial pretrial right, the court will simply not test for prejudice. And in this case, both at the Article 32 investigation and at the court-martial itself, there was timely objection. And because of that, and consistent with this court's opinions, it should set aside the findings for specifications 1 and 2 of charge 2. And if there are no further questions at this point, I'll address the remaining issues on rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. I will now hear from counsel for the government.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Captain Donna Rappel, and I, along with Colonel Gerald Bruce, represent the government in this matter. The single issue in this case is whether the Air Force Court appropriately tested for prejudice. Essentially, the appellant is arguing this court to adopt a per se reversal rule when a substantial pretrial right has been violated. The government asserts that based on Article 59A of the Uniform Code of Military Justice and recent decisions of this court, the error must result in prejudice to afford relief. In this case, the Air Force Court appropriately tested for material prejudice and properly found the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Counsel, 59A refers to findings and sentence issued by a court-martial. Is a ruling on a pretrial motion a finding?
It is a finding made by the judge at trial, yes, Your Honor.
So the way you interpreted that, that does not refer to the formal findings that we generally discuss in the Uniform Code of Military Justice. It refers to any ruling that could occur.
Well, Your Honor, under 66C, when the Air Force Court reviews each case, essentially the underlying issues within the case make up the ultimate findings and sentence. So it's the government's argument that 59A encompasses all of the underlying decisions that make up the findings and sentence of a court-martial.
Is there any precedent from this court that would support that proposition that the word findings, either in Article 59 or Article 66, do not refer literally to the findings that are rendered by the court-martial on the issues of guilt or innocence?
I don't have any precedent right now, Your Honor, but I can certainly supplement it, Your Honor.
Thank you.
If the appellant is correct and he is entitled to a new Article 32, what happens to the finding and sentence in this case?
It would be set aside, Your Honor.
On what basis?
That the military judge abused his discretion. I apologize. As the military judge at trial found, the Article 32 hearing can have violations within it. However, if there is no prejudice...
No, in my question, we're assuming he wins. The appellant is correct that there was error and there was prejudice or whatever, depending on whether we adopt his theory or not. What happens to the finding or the sentence?
At this point in the process, Your Honor?
Or
at
correct.
The trial level? At this point, it should be... tested for material prejudice?
No, I'm sorry. Let me try my question again. Hypothetical.
Okay.
Appellant wins either on the theory that there is prejudice under Article 59 or we don't test for prejudice and it's per se error and so on. What happens to the finding or sentence of the court-martial at this time?
Finding should be set aside and it should be sent back for a rehearing.
You said that the CCA appropriately tested for prejudice. Does that mean you agree with the CCA's analysis that there was constitutional error or that one tests for constitutional error in this context?
Your Honor, it's the government's opinion argument in this case that the Article 32 rights were not violated under RCM 405, as in the Powell decision explained, and therefore a right to a public hearing was not violated under the constitutional Sixth Amendment argument. Therefore, it does not equal a substantial pretrial right.
Are you conceding that there's a Sixth Amendment right to an open Article 32 hearing?
No, Your Honor. That's not what the government is conceding.
Then why are you saying that they appropriately evaluated for prejudice?
The Air Force Court?
Right.
Because based on Article 59A, as well as the recent decisions from this court, past United States v. Shakara, that talks about the testing for prejudice when errors in the Article 32 have occurred, such as United States v. Cruz and United States...
I'm not trying to trick you. Your argument's bifurcated, is it not? It's more nuanced than just saying... You agree that they tested for prejudice, but are you agreeing that they tested using the correct test or not?
Yes, Your Honor.
You are?
Yes, the government argues that the Air Force Court tested for prejudice in this case using Article 59A, not using the precedents under the United States versus Nickel rule, which is what the appellant is arguing in this case.
Did they not test for harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
Yes, Your Honor, they did. However, when they tested for material prejudice, they tested using 59A. They did analyze the case as if it was a violation of the Sixth Amendment and test for material prejudice beyond a reasonable doubt.
Do you agree that that was correct? Do you agree that it was correct for them to analyze this under the Sixth Amendment? I mean...
No, Your Honor, the government does not agree with that assertion that it was a violation of the Sixth Amendment.
Are you arguing that even if their test was correct, that their prejudice analysis, even if the reason that they tested it that way was incorrect, that their prejudice analysis is correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
That they're finding that there was no prejudice is
correct? Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, could you identify in your brief where you challenged the correctness of the ruling of the court below?
Your Honor, there is no place in the brief. Unfortunately, that was not challenged in the brief.
So, there's no certification from the Judge Advocate General. There's no challenge to the brief. Why isn't the decision of the court below the law of the case?
Well, Your Honor, based on the appellant's argument in this case, it would be a material prejudice to the government to not be able to answer that line of questioning here today.
Was a reply brief filed?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Is an Article 32 identical to a grand jury?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
Is an Article 32 identical to a grand jury?
It is similar to a grand jury. Yes, Your Honor.
What rights does an accused, if any, does an accused enjoy in Article 32 that he or she wouldn't have in a grand jury? Is a grand jury a public proceeding?
A grand jury is not a public proceeding, as far as my understanding.
Does the individual have a right to counsel in a grand jury?
I don't believe so.
Does the individual have a right to call witnesses in a grand jury?
I don't believe so, no.
Does the individual have a right to request that the grand jury engage in discovery?
I don't believe so, no. Also, in an Article 32 under RCM 405, it is in the rules that it is preferred to be a public hearing. However, the rules also allow for a determination made by the investigating officer or the commander who ordered the Article 32 to determine on a case-by-case, witness-by-witness, issue-by-issue basis on whether or not the hearing could be closed.
Counsel, I understand your argument that the right to a public Article 32 hearing is not a constitutional right, but are you also arguing that it is not a substantial pretrial right, aside from the constitutional issues?
If the entire Article 32 hearing were closed, it could be a violation of the substantial pretrial right. However, based on the way that the rule is written under Article 32 and RCM 405, it appears that the intent was to allow for portions of the Article 32 to be closed without denying an appellant a substantial pretrial right.
Per se, or depending on what part was closed?
Depending on what part was closed and for what reasons. There is an analysis.
Well, do you think that there's ever a reason that there's per se reversal for denial of any or every substantial pretrial right?
No, Your Honor.
I mean, that's the issue here.
Yes, Your Honor. And it is the government's opinion or argument that, based on Article 59A, as well as the recent case law cited that the defense cites, as well as moving forward in time through U.S. v. Cruz and U.S. v. Johnson, that this court has held that it requires not only a timely objection, but also a showing of prejudice. Both of those must be shown in order for relief to be afforded based on a substantial pretrial right violation.
Can I ask you, just to make sure I understood your response to Judge Erdman, is it the government's view that a partial closure could, in fact, implicate a substantial right? In context?
Hypothetically, that could happen if the analysis was not done correctly or it did not follow the rules or substantially comply with RCM 405.
So in theory, depending on what was closed, it could implicate a substantial right. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Does this, and I don't want to belabor this, but are we dealing with a substantial right here? And what you're talking about is the process that the investigating officer goes through to justify the closure of that portion of the hearing, to justify taking away what would be considered a right or a substantial right. Are you talking more about the procedure, or are you talking about the significance of the right that the appellant is asking to be enforced?
At this point, I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm a bit confused on the question.
In response to the question from Judge Baker, it seemed to me that you said that a partial closure could constitute deprivation of a substantial pretrial right, depending on the circumstances.
Yes, Your Honor.
Those circumstances, as I understood your answer, were that the investigating officer did not properly go through the procedures necessary in order to make the closure.
Yes, Your Honor, or the analysis was flawed.
Or the analysis. So are we dealing with a substantial right to begin with, and you can close it if you perform the right procedural steps?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Let's assume that the defense has raised the issue. Is there a burden on the government at this point to demonstrate the absence of prejudice?
In reading the precedent set by this court, it does not appear that the burden shifts to the government. It appears that the burden remains with the appellant to show that a timely objection was made and that prejudice was shown, or there was prejudice.
And which case would you cite in our Article 32 arena that discusses the issue of burdens and burden shifting?
Well, Your Honor, in my reading of the cases, there isn't a discussion on burdens per se. It appears the way that the court looks at the issue, it looks at whether or not there was prejudice, not necessarily the burden being on the defense to prove it or the government to show an absence of it. It just seems to be a straight discussion of whether or not there was prejudice.
Counsel, in order for you to prevail, are you asking us to overrule the Mickelson, Donaldson, Chestnut, Chocolate, and Murray rule, or can those cases and the rules they discuss still stand?
Your Honor, it's the government's position that Mickel does not need to be overruled. The language in Mickel is cited throughout these cases and is applied differently in Donaldson and Chestnut than it is applied in Chocolat, Cruz, and Johnson. And the government would argue that in Chocolat is the first time that this court attempted to clarify the Mickel rule and actually talked about that the Mickel rule mandates where a defense counsel fails to timely object with no adverse effect at trial, then there's no reason to set aside the conviction. And by the reading of that case, it appears the language in Mickel seems to require more than just a timely objection. In other words, the timely objection isn't enough. There has to be prejudice. And in United States versus Cruz, decided 2 months after Chocolat, this court again clarifies the rule by adding the word and to the analysis, calling for a timely objection and prejudice. And then in United States versus Johnson, found in 2000, that's a case where this court found the appellant had no standing to object to an improper subpoena of his wife at an Article 32 hearing. However, the helpful aspect of that opinion is actually in the analysis of this concept of the Mickel rule in the concurring opinion written by Judge Sullivan. And the government would ask this court to adopt the clear analysis outlined in Sullivan's concurring opinion in U.S. v. Johnson to allow for an unambiguous precedent in this area of law. In that concurring opinion, Judge Sullivan states that there is no per se reversal rule for a court-martial preceded by an Article 32 hearing where a legal error occurred, and that this court looks to the effect of a pretrial error on the trial rather than the lawfulness of the Article 32 inquiry in determining whether a reversible error occurred. It's the government's position that this is an ideal case to clarify that rule and that there is clearly no prejudice to the appellant in this case based on the fact that the witnesses where the Article 32 hearing was closed both provided written statements prior to the Article 32 hearing. The defense counsel was allowed to interview both of them and did so extensively. The Article 32 hearing testimony was the same as was at trial. And at trial, the defense had ample opportunity to cross-examine both of these witnesses. Finally, the appellant was actually acquitted of the three most serious charges in this case, two rape charges and one indecent assault, leaving only two assault consummated by battery of one of those witnesses where the hearing was closed. and then an additional assault consummated by a battery of a third witness, which was open testimony throughout the proceedings. So in this case, there was no prejudice to the appellant.
Under the government's approach, and I noticed in the brief of the court below, the government focused on the fact that there was no extraordinary writ filed. Why wouldn't the government's approach result in a situation in which at every closure, counsel for the defense would feel compelled to file a writ in our court?
My understanding of the reading of the brief to the Air Force Court and the Air Force Court opinion was based on the idea that if a military judge at trial denies your motion regarding the errors at the 32, you could file to the Air Force Court for a writ at that point in time instead of proceeding at trial.
If there's a requirement that the accused show prejudice before the 32 even begins, why doesn't that say to every accused, whenever there's a closure, you better bring your writ, because now's your time to win without having to demonstrate at that point what might result, or in a speculative sense?
Your Honor, the government's position, and I have not been clear on this, is that under the case of Mikkel, this court did establish that at the trial level, there is no need to show prejudice. It is simply after the trial level, at the appellate level, where the requirement to show prejudice develops. And in the Air Force Court decision below, the Air Force Court actually did apply the precedent of Mikkel to the analysis of whether or not the military judge abused his discretion, and found that he did abuse his discretion by testing for prejudice at that level. So they properly applied the Mikkel rule at that point. But then when the Air Force Court went on to test for prejudice, the Air Force Court was testing for prejudice under 59A.
How many rights has this court recognized a per se reversal for deprivation of the rights? I mean, for instance, the court recently heard the Quintanilla case where I believe we found that the military judge had improperly removed a panel member, and we tested for prejudice there. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
What instances that you can tell us has the court not required a showing of prejudice, even where there's constitutional error?
Your Honor, my understanding is that there has, even under constitutional error, there is a test for prejudice under the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard. I cannot cite you to any cases where this court has found a per se reversal rule.
Now, Counsel, I just want to make sure I understand. Is it the government's position that under Mikkel, where there is no requirement that you test for prejudice at trial, at the trial level, that that's still a good rule? Are you challenging that holding in Mikkel? It seemed to me that the statement that you just made, you were okay with that. And then when the CCA took a look at it, they applied 59A in their appellate capacity, and there required prejudice. It seems a little bit disconnected to have a right that upon initial showing, prejudice need not be shown, and then on appeal, for the same analysis, you have to show prejudice. And I'm just confused as to the consistency of that position.
Your Honor, my understanding is of the Mikkel rule is that the language in Mikkel talks about that if an accused is denied of a substantial pretrial right and makes a timely objection at trial, that it is difficult to show prejudice at that point in the proceedings, and therefore is entitled to judicial enforcement at trial.
Does the government agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor. And then Mikkel goes on to say that once the case comes to trial on the merits, the pretrial rights merge with the trial rights. And then at that point in time, it's government's position that showing prejudice may be possible where it may not have been previously, as well as then at the appellate level, under 59A, which comes into play at the appellate level and is not in play at the trial level, as well as the language in Mickle, there is a test for prejudice to go back to the pretrial rights because they have merged into the trial rights.
Counsel, why doesn't this then go back to the earlier question about what the word findings means in terms of prejudice? At the point at which the military judges is ruling at trial, at the outset of trial, there are no findings. So the military judge is determining whether the individual received his or her pretrial rights. On appeal, my understanding of what the Court of Criminal Appeals is saying, in effect, now you have findings. And so for the test for prejudice under Article 59A is, did that error prejudice the findings, that is, the result of trial, guilty or innocent?
Yes, Your Honor.
Does the government agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor. And it's the government's opinion in this case that there was no prejudice. Therefore, the military judge abusing his discretion, as the Air Force Court found, with no prejudice, means that the case is affirmed by the Air Force Court. If there are no further questions, may I briefly conclude?
Please.
In this case, the Air Force Court properly applied a test for prejudice based on Article 59A of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, as well as recent case law. Accordingly, the government asks this court to affirm the Air Force Court's finding.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Judge Baker, to address your earlier question, Your Honor, regarding whether or not the Constitution affords a right to a public Article 32 investigation, we are not advancing the argument that it does necessarily. I think in looking at the Powell decision, this court made clear that that applies as far as a public criminal trial, but it did not specifically talk about the Sixth Amendment directly applying to a pretrial Article 32 investigation. But we do advance the argument that we are still dealing with a substantial pretrial right. And if you go back and look at the line of cases from Mickle through Shukalat, and you look at what the court was determining to be substantial pretrial rights in those cases, we submit that it's analogous in terms of what we're dealing with here. For example, in Mickle, it talked about right to a qualified counsel. Donaldson talked about an Article 32 investigation ordered by an officer empowered to do so. In Chestnut, it talked about the proper production of a witness that had been requested by the defense at the Article 32 investigation. In this case, obviously, we're dealing with the closure of the Article 32 investigation to two the pivotal government witnesses. We would disagree with the way in which the government interpreted some of the cases that are in that line from Mickle through Shukalat. I think the court in Shukalat stated that Donaldson, the decision of Donaldson, is critical to a proper reading of the language that was set out in Mickle. And if you look at the analysis that they did in Donaldson, it makes clear that, for example, in the situation where the defense did object to the charge that dealt with a properly convened Article 32 investigation, the court did not do a prejudice analysis in that case. It simply agreed that the officer that ordered the investigation did not have the power to do so, and as a result, the court set aside the findings and the sentence for that without engaging in any kind of prejudice analysis.
Isn't that a structural error that basically renders it null and void? It was convened by somebody who couldn't convene it. How does that relate to something like this where it's an improper closure of a portion of it?
Well, there are obviously different situations, Your Honor, but I think arguably the having the hearing closed to the two pivotal government witnesses is even more compelling of an interest than the situation that you had in Donald.
Situation in which the whole thing's a nullity?
Agreed,
almost by definition.
Correct. I agreed, Your Honor.
How do you answer the government's pointing to Judge Sullivan's concurrence in Johnson as the way we ought to go?
Well, Your Honor, in response to the government's argument on the concurring opinion in Sullivan, we submit that that concurring opinion is not necessarily inconsistent with this other line of cases.
Well, he said there wasn't any per se rule and that basically you had to test.
Yes, Your Honor, but in the language that he uses in his concurring opinion, he doesn't specifically mention substantial pretrial rights. He just talks about any legal error, and we would agree that that there is no, at least when you're looking at this court's previous decisions, it's not stated that for any kind of legal error, we're going to have this per se rule, but just when you have a deprivation of a substantial pretrial rights, we would submit there's really no inconsistency on the face of it with what he's stating there.
Counsel, going back, I think, to a question that Judge Baker asked at the very beginning, isn't it possible to read Mikkel so that it jives or is consistent with Rule 59? I mean, I understand that Mikkel goes on to talk about a situation where an accused has not made an objection, but it doesn't start that way. It starts by making some fairly broad statements on page 326 of the opinion. We agree with the Board of Review that the pretrial investigation is an integral part of the general court-martial proceedings and that the right to counsel is a fundamental right therein. However, there is a substantial difference between a defect in the preliminary proceedings and a defect in the trial proceedings. A defect in the preliminary proceedings will not justify setting aside a conviction unless it clearly appears that the error prejudiced the accused in some material respect of the trial. And that initial section of the case does not turn on the fact that there was no objection. I mean, it's a standalone discussion of the need to show prejudice at the trial level for denial of a pretrial right.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, we would submit that Article 59A can be read consistently with Mikkel, and primarily because, again, I think alluding to some of the discussion that occurred during the government's argument that, you know, here we're really dealing with just a pretrial a matter during the initial investigation as opposed to something that's going towards the findings or the sentence of the court-martial as discussed in Article 59A. And I think Mikkel, when it talks about the pretrial rights merging with the rights at trial, we would submit that, you know, that occurs when at least there's been no objection to any of the pretrial proceedings, that there's been no deprivation of a substantial pretrial right. But in this case where you have that the case never should have gone forward to a court-martial.
Okay, and it doesn't matter that in Mikkel that what the accused didn't have was qualified counsel during the Article 32 investigation?
Well, the problem in Mikkel really was that there was no objection at the trial.
Okay, and I'm sorry, I see your time has expired, but I'm just focusing on the discussion at the beginning of the case that doesn't turn on that point.
Yes, Your Honor, I acknowledge that language is in there. It's somewhat, the entire Mikkel opinion I would submit is somewhat difficult to, there's parts of it that appear to be inconsistent with other parts, but, and if I may briefly conclude, our interpretation of the Mikkel opinion does require that because there was a time objection in this case and because of substantial pretrial right, the appellant was deprived of it, that those affected specifications should be set aside.
Thank you, counsel. And we thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The court will stand in recess until 10 o'clock this morning. Our second case this morning is United States against Sanchez. Counsel for the defense.
Thank you. May it please the court. My name is Captain Seth Director, and I, along with Lieutenant Colonel Stephen Hendricks, represent the appellant in this case, Specialist Luis Sanchez. Concern for sexual abuse, probable for sexual abuse, based upon a clear, consistent history of sexual abuse, abnormal. These were the expert conclusions proffered by Dr. Nancy Kellogg over defense objection. These are the conclusions that are the basis for the issue before this court, when such conclusions were, one, unreliable because the conclusions for the three annual general findings were predicated on Dr. Kellogg's untested, undependable clinical experience and nebulous medical findings, and two, unreliable because the overall assessment of sexual abuse was not trustworthy based upon the testimony and research available at the time of trial. This court has adopted the Supreme Court's decision in Daubert for testing reliability of expert evidence under MRE 702 and also United States versus Hauser. Appellant readily admits that the four factors identified in Daubert are not a definitive checklist and that there is a flexibility standard. However, this flexibility standard does not infer that there is no standard. Instead, as Comey Tire indicates, a judge can place emphasis on any one of the four factors using it as a guidepost or, and I emphasize, other indications of reliability when applicable. In this case, the military judge does, in fact, at least on a cursory basis, appear to use the four factors that are set forth in Daubert. She identifies no alternative indice of reliability, other than Dr. Kellogg's experience and familiarity with scholarly research. Specifically, the military judge provides a cursory analysis that states there was not general acceptance in the scientific community, there was no known rate of error, it was difficult to test, and it had been subject to peer review and publication, although it was hotly contested. However, this fails in that it fails to distinguish between exactly what findings she's looking for. The defense proffered three different types of anal genital findings under Daubert, and also an overall assessment, and the military judge makes no semblance of that in her findings. Additionally, she does conclude, again, conclusory, that Dr. Kellogg's testimony had been subject to peer review and publication, but she doesn't state exactly what any general finding that's related to, nor does she state exactly what publication or peer review that's subject to. Based upon these findings, it's evident that the military judge abused discretion in applying MRE 702 and Daubert. We can look at that when we evaluate the three specific any general findings. Specifically, in this case, the hymenal rim research, and this is really broken down into two specific areas of research. Number one, she overall testifies that Jasmine's hymen was abnormal compared to children her age, specifically that the height of the hymenal rim was too short and a portion of the hymenal rim was too thick. As to the too short, basically this is the overall dimension of the hymen, not in terms of the circumference, but in terms of the actual height. She admits that this is 2.5 millimeters long. This is the one finding that she did, in fact, make specific calculations upon, and that this is the measurement that she took. And she also testifies that this is, in fact, abnormal. However, later on, she goes on to testify that this measurement was normal. And this coincides, her testimony, which is a 1 to 4 millimeter hymenal height, would be considered normal. This coincides with all the research that was provided both by the defense counsel and the limited research provided at the trial by the prosecution.
Counsel, before you leave that,
yes, sir.
Is it critical to the defense case as to whether it was abnormal or normal? That is, did the witness or the military judge link any abnormality in this regard to any scientific study or finding regarding abuse?
I would say yes, Your Honor, and specifically throughout her testimony, and then in more depth when she makes her overall assessment as to both the anogenital findings and also to the overall assessment as to sexual abuse. And specifically, she uses the term, and to some degree she uses them interchangeably, abnormal, and more specifically, concerning for abuse. And this is really predicated on the study that was introduced at trial, the Dr. Adams study, basically.
Okay, and what was the logic that was presented as to the link between abnormality and abuse?
Principally, the logic should have been based upon some...
Not should have been. What was presented, that is, did the judge, did the witness testify, or did the judge conclude that there was a logical connection between abnormality and abuse? And if so, what was that based on?
Your Honor, and again, I would say yes, and the rationale specifically as to this anogenital finding was it was not in fact concerning, specifically because the research presented at trial demonstrates that this hymenal thickening, which we'll address in a second, and also the hymenal shortness, does not have a reliable indicator for concerning for abuse.
You're not answering Judge Efron's question, I don't believe. Was there an analytic step involved here that you're skipping over? Did the witness say white blood cell count or thickening of the hymen, therefore child abuse, QED?
Yes, Your Honor.
She didn't make a conclusion that these are indicators of trauma and the trauma is an indicator of child abuse?
Again, Your Honor, it depends on what type of anogenital finding we're addressing. And specifically, I'll address Dr. Long's, Mrs. Long's testimony, where she did find, in fact, that it was consistent with either penetration or sexual abuse. However, as it relates specifically to Dr. Kellogg's testimony, she did, in fact, testify at length that this was consistent with sexual abuse, not just trauma.
I understand that, but what was the scientific basis for the conclusion that it was consistent with abuse? That is, what science did the, or logic, did the witness bring into the courtroom to demonstrate that the expertise that the individual possessed was applied to, in a logical sequence, to draw a link from size, we're just talking about the size issue, to abuse? Did the witness provide any information regarding trauma, as Judge Baker has raised, that size has a scientific relationship to trauma?
I would say yes, Your Honor. I mean, the link over really is through her clinical experience and through whatever research was presented at trial. I think that's the connection that you're looking to make, the major premise versus the
moment. And right. And if there's a link between size and trauma, and if that is a scientifically valid link, at least for purposes of Daubert, where would the error be?
Well, Your Honor, number one, as it relates to the anogenic finding we were specifically talking about, there was no finding really of abnormality. I mean, her findings specifically were within the scope of what would be considered normal anogenital findings based upon the research presented at trial. And I'll try to address them, sir, if I can.
So that your answer there is that the evidence didn't support the science as opposed to the absence of science?
Yes, Your Honor.
Would you agree then that if the evidence was of size and an abnormal size, that would have been admissible evidence under Daubert on the issue of trauma in this case?
Your Honor, based upon the case research provided and the testimony of all the witnesses, if she had made specific findings that as to the length of the hymen or the height of the hymen, it was below 1 millimeter in length. I think the research provided at trial and through the expert would in fact indicate that that is concerning for or abnormal. or a reliable indicator for sexual abuse.
So your answer to the Chief Judge's question is yes, then?
Yes, yes, Your Honor. I apologize. As to the second issue, which is really provided through the Heimdall Rim research, which is the thickening. And again, if we look at the Daubert factors that were applied at trial, they testified at length that there was no case studies related to this, that the evidence was extremely controversial, that there was no precise standard by which they applied the Heimdall Rim research or the Heimdall Rim thickening. In addition to that,
is it your contention that is this junk science or is it simply controversial? I mean, controversy, as long as it's presented, that's a question for the trier of fact. Is it your contention that there's nothing here and it ought not to have even gone in?
Yes, Your Honor. That doesn't mean in total for anogenital findings, but specifically as was related at trial, meaning that what she testified to, based upon the factual things that she found, it was not reliable science. It should not have been permitted.
But what standard?
Controversial.
What's the standard for reliable science? What can go in and what can't?
I'm not sure if I understand your question, sir.
Well, you're saying it's junk, basically. Well, what's the standard? Standard's the standard enunciated in Daubert. That's a pretty permissive standard.
And appellant acknowledges that, which is clearly there's a deference towards allowing evidence into testimony. However, this court and an underlying court still have to make a determination as to admissibility. It's not a free-for-all, meaning that not every single bit of evidence can come in. And specifically, as it relates to the facts in this case, the anogenital findings and the overall assessment were simply unreliable.
Are you saying that they're unreliable? I'm sorry. Are you saying that they're unreliable because she got the facts wrong? Or are you saying that they're unreliable because the basis for looking at the facts is indicative of trauma and indicative of child sexual abuse, is unreliable as a matter of science?
Well, complicated, and then I would say both. And the reason why I say both is because There were different types of actual Daubert findings made in this record, and some of them would have been reliable indicators if the evidence sufficiently supported it, and others were simply, as you alluded to, Your Honor, junk science, meaning that there is no reliable scientific evidence to base that opinion on.
So perhaps it would help if you take the two items you first talked about, the abnormal rim and thickening, and contrast those in terms of which aspects of Daubert are problematical from the defense perspective.
Yes, Your Honor. And specifically as it relates to the Heimdall rim height, that means the thinness of it, too short. Appellant concedes that under Daubert, if the evidence had been sufficiently put forth that the actual height of it or the shortness of it was less than 1 millimeter, that would be a reliable indicator of sexual abuse, concern for sexual abuse. However, in this case, the evidence put forth is that it was 2.5 millimeters, and that is well within the normal spectrum that both Dr. Kellogg testified to, that was admitted in nauseam from the defense standpoint, and specifically cited in Defense Exhibit Alpha, Bravo through Foxtrot, Muffert.
Then what's the contrast to the defense position with respect to thickening?
As it respects to thickening, sir, Your Honor, if we look at the actual Daubert factors as to whether or not this is the overall, the major premise is considered reliable, clearly as evidence at trial, it's simply not. There's been no analytical studies done. There's been no significant case research done. There was admissions both from Dr. Kellogg and also through the actual research that there was no normative standard to apply it to, meaning that as Dr. Kellogg testified, she had no normal standard to apply her thickness analysis to.
She said that there was no normal standard or that there was no study with a control group because there's no reliable way to have a control group for that type of a study.
Your Honor, I think as it relates to the hymenal thickening, it's the latter. And again, Dr. Kellogg didn't necessarily enunciate exactly what studies were out there, what studies weren't out there. It was basically elicited through cross-examination. And through cross-examination, I think it's pretty clear that Dr. Kellogg, in fact, indicated that we don't have a good control group in order to create a normal standard. And specifically as it relates to thickening, she, in fact, indicated that she doesn't even know what her basis for establishing normal versus abnormal was in this case. I mean, that she couldn't recall exactly where she developed her actual normal standard.
Did the witness testify, assume with respect to those things which she had identified as abnormal, did she testify as to what would lead her to believe there was abuse related to the abnormality?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think it was twofold. Number one, she basically made an overall assessment of her annual general findings, meaning that based upon this one annual general finding combined with the other ones, she made an overall assessment that this was, in fact, concerning for abuse. However, obviously the research that was provided at trial and as elicited through cross-examination indicates that that's not, in fact, the case, meaning that there's no research that supports the contention that more than one abnormal or nonspecific annual general finding would somehow indicate a concerning for abuse standard. And secondly, what she then did after on basically sue rebuttal is, well, the military judge allowed the expert, Dr. Kellogg, to testify that based upon your overall assessment of these anal genital findings, what do you find? I find it probable, based upon her clear, consistent history of sexual abuse, meaning that part of how she was making her determination whether or not it was in fact concerning for abuse was based upon the statements and the indices that Jasmine gave her during her limited conversations with her.
Well, are you saying she testified as the ultimate issue?
Your Honor, on Surabal, specifically as it relates to her probable finding, I think it does ultimately start to fall into the purview of the fact finder, meaning that when she testifies that it's probable based upon a clear, consistent history of sexual abuse, I think that's when the link over becomes to the truthfulness of the witness. If we quickly look at the other anal genital findings, specifically the high white blood cell count, there are two fundamental problems here. Number one, the major premise. There was no specific studies done. If you look at the full Daubert factors, they were not analyzed at all. And number two, as a minor premise, what would be considered normal for Jasmine? Dr. Kellogg, in fact, never indicates exactly, besides just stating that it was, in fact, abnormal, she never indicates why it's abnormal. She has no normative standard to go off of. She doesn't testify exactly what the actual white blood cell count is. She just proffered that it was abnormal. Finally, if we look at anal dilation, and this is obviously a hotly contested issue as evidence at trial, she testified that the external and internal sphincter of the anus was dilated, and this was, in fact, concerning for abuse. And unfortunately, the only evidence that's offered at trial is a McCain study, a Dr. McCain study, that indicates that 49% of the overall individuals that he analyzed, that means non-abused and abused, had some marked immediate anal dilation. As a major premise, appellant would concede that if marked anal dilation over 2 millimeters was found in this case, then that would be considered concerning for abuse based upon the research provided. However, in this case, as to the minor premise, Dr. Kellogg was not in fact able to testify in any length or at all as to the actual length of the dilation, excuse me. And finally, we get on to the overall.
So the anal dilation, you put in the same category as to the height issue, and that is that those are matters for which a prosecution could put on scientific evidence. And then the question would be whether the evidence matched up with the studies. Whereas with the thickening in the white blood cell, your argument is that there's no scientific evidence linking those two matters to abuse.
Yes, Your Honor. If the evidence had sufficiently supported the available research at the time as to length or the actual or the width of the dilation, then we probably wouldn't be here. But that's not, in fact, what occurred in this case. And again, as to the overall assessment of her anal genital findings, Dr. Kellogg basically testified that in total, that means all three anal genital findings together somehow qualified for a concern for abuse standard. However, the only available research we have at trial is Dr. Adams' testimony, which specifically indicates that there is no study that supports that contention. Finally, once we find the actual prejudice in this case, we need to get on to exactly what the prejudice would be. Obviously, this is reviewed under a substantially sway standard. In this case, what we critically have is a credibility question, meaning that there is very little evidence offered at trial as to guilt, meaning that Jasmine testified, and beyond that, it was purely the two experts that testified. In contention to that, the defense obviously presented the DNA expert who evidenced that there was no, in fact, physical symptoms or physical signs of either blood or semen. In addition to that, you have ample evidence both provided through the mother of the appellant, through Mrs. Sanchez, the appellant's ex-wife, and also through appellant's lawyer at the time, that there was an attempt to really coach the witness through his testimony. And therefore, as related in Bergstall, where a similar fact pattern arose, this in fact substantially swayed the panel. Absent no further questions from the panel.
Thank you, counsel. You'll have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for the government.
May it please the court, I am Captain Mike Freese, and along with Lieutenant Colonel Michelle Shields, we represent the United States. The military judge in this case did not abuse her discretion in allowing Dr. Kellogg to testify. Dr. Kellogg's testimony was relevant, reliable, and extremely probative. What appellant is essentially asking this court to do is turn back the hands of time and reestablish the strict standard of general acceptance within the field, which the Supreme Court rejected in Daubert and Kumho-Tyre, and this court rejected in Gibson and Hauser. Because the military judge properly followed MRE 702, Hauser, and Daubert, the granted issue is without merit, and this court should respectfully affirm the findings of the Army Corps. The standard of review in this case. A military judge's acceptance of an expert witness is reviewed for an abuse of discretion, and the Supreme Court has stated that deference is the hallmark of the abuse of discretion review. This court has stated that an appellate court will only reverse if a military judge either used an incorrect legal standard or the judge's conclusions are clearly erroneous. And this court stated in Billings, echoing the Supreme Court in Kumho-Tyre, that a military judge has the same broad latitude in determining how to decide reliability as it does in its ultimate conclusion of reliability. Appellant does not challenge any of the military judge's conclusions as clearly erroneous. But as you know, the prevailing military rule of evidence in this matter is MRE 702, which states that if scientific, technical, or other specialized knowledge will assist the trier of fact, a witness qualifies an expert by knowledge, skill, experience, training, or education may testify thereto. And as this court stated in Mustafa, a witness need not be an expert in the strictest sense of the word, but only someone who can help the fact finder. It's important to note the true nature of Dr. Kellogg's testimony, where she made four separate findings as to Jasmine's anal genital conditions. She found, first, focalized thickening of the hymenal rim. Now, that word focalized is very important. It's a word that my opponent did not use in his argument. And why that's important is when you're talking about the thickening and the thinning of Jasmine's hymenal rim, there should be viewed in conjunction. Because when looking at prosecution exhibits 9A, 9B, and 9C, you can see Jasmine's hymenal rim. And what Dr. Kellogg is testifying to is a focalized area of trauma. That's why the 2.5-millimeter measurement versus the 1-to-4-millimeter standard is important. Dr. Kellogg's testifying that, yes, the height of Jasmine's hymenal rim is within the normal standards, but because we have focalized trauma, that is, not the entire hymen being a certain height or thickness, because it's focalized, that's abnormal. And you can review that testimony at pages 320 to 323 of the record of trial during the pretrial hearing. And she admits that Dr. Adams' classification scale for the hymen, that is the 1 to 4 millimeters, is correct and that Jasmine's hymen falls within that area. But the problem in Jasmine's case is that we have focalized thickening and thinning.
Counsel, if the studies have been able to focus on the height and dilation in terms of comparing abused and non-abused, or traumatized and non-traumatized individuals, is there any explanation as to why there aren't similar studies with respect to thickening and white blood cell?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And Dr. Kellogg testified to that fact during the pretrial hearing when she talks about, as Judge Ryan alluded to, the absence of a normative population. When doing comparative analysis in sexually abused children, it's a lot different than, for example, testing people who have a disease such as diabetes, where you can compare people who have diabetes against people who don't and see what characteristics the two groups have in common or in opposition.
Well, was there an absence of normative population with respect to the studies regarding height and anal dilation?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, because
Then why is the defense conceded, and I'm asking you a question for them, but why would the defense agree that those studies were permissible and these are not?
Well, because there are studies, there is literature which the government and more so the defense brought forth during the pretrial hearing that suggests that certain height, for example, a height below 1 millimeter would be abnormal. But again, that's talking about the totality of the hymen, that is, the entire hymen having a height below 1 millimeter.
But don't those studies also, and I may be mistaken on this, but don't those studies also relate those factors to trauma?
Yes, they do, Your Honor. And and to get back to your original question, yes, there are studies out there that say that trauma may reduce a hymen to less than 1 millimeter. So the defense is correct to say that there is literature out there that supports that.
And scientifically, why can there not be studies that address the relationship between thickening or white blood cell and trauma?
To be honest with you, Your Honor, I don't know the correct answer to that question, because the reason why a normative population, as discussed, it's difficult to come up with a normative population. The reason why some of the studies are out there saying that these symptoms are present in situations where there are trauma is because you have people who have either admitted to sexually molesting a child or where they've been proven guilty in a court of law and the child is examined and there are these
right.
Findings.
So they've had those normative populations for two of the categories, but not for two others. And so the question that I have with respect to both thickening and white blood cell is, what is the logical connection that was presented on the record at trial between thickening or white blood cell and trauma? I saw the testimony as to abnormality.
Right, Your Honor.
But what's the logical steps that were set forth in a scientific manner between those two matters, thickening and white blood cell and trauma?
Well, with white blood cell, that's the easier one. I'll do that one first, John. With white blood cell, she said, Dr. Kellogg testified that an increased white blood cell count or vaginitis is rare in a child the age of Jasmine, and that it's caused by two different primary causes, either infection or irritation. And because she tested negative for all the sexually transmitted diseases, Dr. Keller was able to rule out infection, leaving irritation. So the science behind that is simply that irritation caused a high white blood cell count. Therefore, there must have been some type of irritation of the vaginal area, which, of course, would support the possibility of penetration.
And as to thickening?
As to thickening, again, Your Honor, the government would urge the court to read Dr. Kellogg's testimony in conjunction with the thinning, because it's the same area. What we have is top to bottom thinning, front to back thickening. It's almost as if Jasmine's hymen was flattened in that particular portion. And so when you look at the fact that women, as they mature, the estrogen levels go up and the entire hymen will thicken from front to back and thin from top to bottom. It didn't happen in this case. We have a focalized thinning and a focalized thickening. And because it's only one portion of the hymen, as opposed to the normal general hymenal thinning and thickening, that would indicate some type of trauma to that area because it wasn't the entire hymen, but rather one portion of the hymen.
But in that sense, and just to confirm here, the witness did not point to any study to show that that in fact is a scientific possibility.
That's correct.
That is that it's a result of trauma as opposed to any number of other physiological factors.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So.
And, you know, in looking at Dr. Kellogg's findings, there's two things to keep in mind when looking at how she testified. The appellant, both in his argument and his brief, isolates each of the anogenital findings and applies each of them to a strict four-part Daubert test. But what Dr. Kellogg testified to was that her opinion was based on all of the symptoms taken together, that is a multi-system basis, and that no one of the anogenital findings would serve as an appropriate basis for her opinion that Jasmine was concerning for sexual abuse. And second, and this gets to the ultimate issue, the United States versus Birdsall issue that was raised, she consistently admitted both during the pretrial hearing and when she testified on the merits that there are other normal causes for these symptoms and that those other normal causes could have caused these symptoms. At no time did she testify that this was the result of trauma or penetration. For example, one example is the anal dilation, where she says if she had encopresis or if she had diarrhea or if she had stool present, all of these things could cause anal dilation. Now, in the Daubert opinion, Justice Blackmun discusses three key protections against shaky evidence. He states vigorous cross-examination, presentation of contrary evidence, and careful instruction on the burden of proof are the traditional and appropriate means of attacking shaky but admissible evidence. All three of Justice Blackmun's protections were present in this case. First, cross-examination. The military judge stated on page 370 that cross-examination by the defense will further guarantee reliability and the member's understanding. And sure enough, appellant's counsel did vigorously cross-examine Dr. Kellogg, both during the pretrial hearing and in front of the members. Second, instructions on the burden of proof. The military judge did properly instruct the panel on the burden of proof, but she went further by limiting Dr. Kellogg's testimony and by instructing the panel that the two expert witnesses, Dr. Kellogg and Ms. Long, cannot confirm what Jasmine stated, that they don't have that ability. And finally, the presentation of contrary evidence. As my opponent mentioned in his argument, the defense was fully free to present contrary evidence. They did challenge Dr. Kellogg during cross-examination with the studies of Dr. McCann and Dr. Adams. So all three of the protections that Justice Blackmun envisions in the Daubert opinion were present in this case.
But if one looks at the following cases, Joyner and Kumho-Tyre, isn't there an initial gatekeeper responsibility upon the judge before you even get into cross-examination or instructions to ensure that there is a logical connection between the expertise that is offered and the conclusion that the expert is giving? So, for example, in these cases, simply stating that there was an abnormality and therefore was abuse, and I'm not suggesting that that was the testimony, but if that were all that were there, wouldn't it be the obligation of the judge to say this expert has to relate what there is in science that gets you from abnormality to abuse?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The expert witness cannot just testify on ipse dixit. The expert can't just state, I feel this is what happened, and therefore, the federal cases that appellant cites in his brief, Scott v. Cooper and some of the others, are perfect examples of where the military judge properly exercised his gatekeeper function. And those are the cases where the witness could not close the analytical gap between what they were testifying to and what the evidence showed. This is not that case. If you look at the military judge's findings of fact, she does close the gap between what Dr. Kellogg observed and what she testified to. Military judge's findings are found on page 367 through 372. She first states that Dr. Kellogg was eminently qualified to testify based on her education and her experience, and more importantly, that her testimony would assist the fact finder and put the facts of this case in context. She talks about the sufficient factual basis, that is, that she's greatly familiar with the materials of the leading experts, that she's examined over 6,000 children who were suspected of being abused, and that she's been a pediatrician for over 10 years. But more importantly, she gets to the reliability of Dr. Kellogg's testimony. And I think this is what you're alluding to, Your Honor, how her observations get to her conclusion that it's concerning for abuse. The military judge found on page 369 that Dr. Kellogg's opinions have been subjected to peer review and publication. That error rate for many of the findings are impossible to determine for the reasons that we discussed earlier, the lack of a normative population. That the measurements used in the field, the 2.5 millimeter versus 1 to 4 millimeters, those don't go to admissibility, they go to weight, because those are the proper measurements used in the field, as defense conceded. And again, the military judge was particularly impressed with Dr. Kellogg's objectivity. Dr. Kellogg testified that routinely the children that she examines for possible sexual abuse are referred to her after there's already been a finding of sexual abuse, and she testified that she concurs with the initial finding of sexual abuse in roughly 50% of those cases.
Finish your sentence.
Just that the military judge was particularly impressed by that statistic of objectivity.
Counsel, I know that Dr. Kellogg testified about having given testimony in other courts. Am I correct about that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Had she given testimony on these specific sorts of findings?
Your Honor, I don't think that Dr. Kellogg got into that. I think that she testified that she has testified in, I believe, 600 trials. That number eludes me. I believe it's 600. I'm not entirely sure. But she said that 80% of the time she testifies, it's for lack of a better term, it's for the government, that she is corroborating a claim of sexual abuse, but that 20% she is disputing a claim of child abuse. Again, as my opponent mentioned during his argument, Kumho Tyre leaves open the possibility that a military judge or a trial judge can use other indicia of reliability to weigh expert testimony. And this notion of objectivity that the military judge in this case considered in determining Dr. Kellogg's reliability is such an appropriate indicia of reliability. Finally, the military judge...
Why?
I'm sorry, Aaron?
Why? If somebody can be objective in the sense of not being biased, doesn't mean that they have any idea what they're talking about.
No, of course, Your Honor. Standing alone, it would not be a very strong indication of reliability. But when we have a situation like this where the testimony does not fit neatly and squarely into the four Daubert factors, it's something else the military judge can consider. Now, the military judge did do a proper military rule of evidence 403 balancing test on the record, stating that the probative value of Dr. Kellogg's testimony was not outweighed by unfair prejudice, and that cross-examination by the defense would further guarantee reliability and decrease the potential for prejudice. As I mentioned in my introduction, the appellant does not challenge any of the military judge's findings as clearly erroneous. He simply attacks the military judge's ultimate determination of reliability. This court stated in United States v. Bush that an appellate court is not the appropriate place to relitigate a motion to admit expert testimony. That's exactly what appellant is trying to do today by making an end run around the abuse of discretion standard. Furthermore, appellant, by pointing out the lack of studies that back up Dr. Kellogg's opinions, is basically arguing that the general acceptance within the field should be the definitive test for the admission of scientific evidence. And again, this court and the Supreme Court have rejected that argument. There are no further questions. I'll be able to conclude. The military judge in this case did not abuse her discretion in allowing Dr. Kellogg to testify. Dr. Kellogg's expert medical opinion was reliable, relevant, and probative. As such, the granted issue is without merit, and the government respectfully requests this court to affirm the Army Court's ruling. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
Your Honor, to specifically address exactly how this court should incorporate or interpret the any general findings in the overall assessment, specifically, I think the Daubert factors in this case do in fact apply, meaning that as evidenced in the record and also through the line of questioning from Your Honor, it's clear that they can establish a normative standard, and that's really the applicable rule under Daubert. It's not whether they have, it's whether they did.
Just to make it clear, I was asking a question, not making a point.
Okay, Your Honor. So clearly, I think as we look at the four identified Daubert factors, as this court obviously incorporated through Billings, these, for all the any general findings, could in fact be applied if someone so choose to do so. And as it appears, at least from the government's perspective, they're actually conceding that either all or none of the Daubert factors, in fact, apply for each specific any general finding. They don't want to go into an analysis of that. They're more looking towards what it appears a comparative analysis, a clinical research perspective. The problem in this case with that perspective is exactly as the government alluded to, ipsa dixa, meaning that the Dr. Kellogg did not testify at all as to how she assesses each individual any general finding, meaning that there's no normative standard within her clinical research. And the problem with that, of course, is her just simply testifying that she's examined 5,000 cases, 6,000 cases, she's found 50%, showing signs of abuse, does not articulate exactly what type of abuse is demonstrated. Is this an acute sign, like a tearing of the hymen, or something that's obviously more amorphous, such as a high white blood cell count? So it's exactly what ipsa dixa means, which is a bare assertion based upon itself. There's no factual predicate that backs up her clinical research, basically. At least that was provided at trial. Your Honor, as the government counsel alluded to the focalized trauma, specifically as it relates to the thickening of the hymen, the problem, of course, is just as I alluded to before, which is ipsa dixa, meaning that the government concedes that there's no studies that this is based on. They're alluding that it's because they can't establish a normative standard, although I'll obviously point out that a normative standard was applied, obviously, to other anogenital findings. But they're also alluding to the fact that her clinical research demonstrates that she should be able to determine that this is, in fact, thick. The problem with this, in this case, is both during the findings and also during the actual court-martial, she never specifies exactly what would be considered thick in her book, exactly how she assesses that from a clinical research standpoint. So, number one, I would assert that the Daubert factor should, in fact, apply in this case. And additionally, if we're looking at more of a Como tire, meaning not a specific scientific analysis, there is no alternative indicia of reliability that supports any of the anogenital findings or the overall assessment for anogenital findings or sexual abuse, which you ultimately testified to. If there's no further questions from the court.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted. This concludes our arguments for this week, and the court will stand adjourned.
The court stands adjourned until further order of the court.